Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It's Monday, July 6th, 2026. My name is Magnus Tewald.
And I'm Peter R.H.
And we've got a fine show for you today. We're going to start off with a report on the BC Nurses Union, which is issued a 72-hour strike notice to the government. They've been in contract talks for a while. So we'll learn more about that. We also have a report on an effort to create a low-income transit pass for Vancouver, and also a report from Danny on the recent Burnaby Record Fair. So a bit of an excuse to talk about music. We had Gardening with Embark, and what are you talking about today, Peter?
Well, I'm going to be talking about the fact that 18% of the native reservations in Canada is still under a boiled water, what they call it, boiled water
advisory.
And in some cases, what I was checking into, even that's not good. Like, it's good not even to use the boiled water. And Wednesday, there was a show for the United States. Mm-hmm. It was about how in California there were a community there, and they were actually either farm workers or some such thing. They only had 4 liters a week, which is, in Canada, we have the same thing for one of them.
Yeah.
I mean, a bottled water. And in that case, it's because of the groundwater.
Right.
Okay, it's I'm back. I do my tablet as okay. Anyway, it's groundwater. There's a specific reason for the groundwater being contaminated, but so I thought, well, we have a problem here too. So,
yeah, and it's been a problem for a long time,
even past 11 years ago when Justin Trudeau was supposed to solve it for us.
Yeah, and I think it might. You know, I think. Stephen Harper also made some claims, but yeah. So it goes back a long way. It's, you know, and it's kind of shameful that not more has been done after all this time. Anyway, we will talk about that later in the show. First up, though, here is the BC Nurses Union has issued strike notice.
The BC Nurses Union has issued a 72-hour strike notice after its members voted to reject a tentative agreement that had been reached in late May after 7 months of collective bargaining. Speaking at a press conference on Monday, BCNU President Adrian Geer said the 60,000 members of the union, who are now in a legal position to take job action as of noon on Thursday, July 2nd, are demanding that their frustrations with worsening working conditions be heard.
Nurses are demanding that our work be valued, and we are demanding that government and health employers recognize a simple truth. There is no healthcare system without nurses. For many nurses, this is more than a collective agreement. It is about a profession that has reached a breaking point. It is about nurses who can no longer stay silent as they watch experienced and novice colleagues leave the profession injured and burnt out.
In total, 67% of union members rejected the tentative deal that had been reached with the Health Employers Association of BC. The rejected deal had included improvements to benefits coverage and a general wage increase of 12% over 4 years. Geer suggested that given the severity of working conditions for nurses, the union's members are demanding that the government and health employers prioritize their needs and patient safety first.
This is fundamentally a conversation about priorities. Nurses understand that the provincial government is facing financial difficulties. However, this government has shown it can find resources when something is a priority. For example, over $500 million spent on private agency nursing, or hundreds of millions to host an international sporting event. Today, nurses are demanding that healthcare be a priority for this government, that patient safety be a priority, and that the very people holding the healthcare system together be a priority.
BC Health Minister Josie Osborne said in a statement that nurses are valued members of the healthcare system and that the government respects the right of all workers to bargain collectively, including the decision by union members to take job action. She added that she believes the best agreements are found at the bargaining table and that the government is giving the Health Employers Association and the Nurses Bargaining Association space to conduct their negotiations. Gear says the union is still committed to reaching a new collective agreement through bargaining, but stressed that they are also ready to take job action. She said that action could take different forms, including banning nurses from performing non-nursing duties, restricting overtime, or withdrawing labor, as long as essential service levels are maintained.
But that is the last thing that we want to do. And so by giving this notice, we hope that the government and the employer responds and finds a way to address the concerns of nurses in this province so that we don't have to take that extraordinary step.
The Health Employers Association of BC issued a statement saying that they would also like to return to the bargaining table and are available to meet with the union at any time to find a path forward. They added that BC has essential services orders in place for the health sector to prevent immediate and serious danger to the health of the public in case of any job action. Health Minister Osborne also assured the public that in the event of job action, people will continue to get the health care they need. She added that the Labor Board has robust processes in place to thoughtfully set what constitutes an essential service. Kootenai Co-op Radio reached out to both the Health Employers Association and the BC Nurses Union to inquire if the parties had returned to the bargaining table, but neither party responded by deadline. For Kootenai Co-op Radio News and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Jamie Frederick.
Thanks to Kootenai Co-op Radio for that report. That's going to be a story where we'll be following over the summer, and we'll see where that goes with negotiations. A 72-hour strike notice doesn't mean they're going to strike right away, but it does mean that their bargaining group, if they feel they get to a point where there's an impasse or they're not making the progress they feel they need, they can actually move to a strike after with 3 days' notice. So we'll see how that goes over the summer. Have you been following the World Cup at all, Peter?
I'm a non-sports person. I know, it's just, at least nobody is doing the high sticking and hockey fights. But one the thing that's sort of good is that, in a sense, it's we got people. I think we have, I don't know if they're able to afford the tickets, but they got people from around the world. So it's not like, it's not just about Canada winning. It's more, and if Canada's out, so people may feel an affinity either for their own ethnicity or their nationality, or just that they kind of like a certain other country. So it's sort of, it's a bit more progressive than the Stanley Cup riots.
Yes, definitely more progressive than the riots. It has been fun. I live close to where, to the stadium, and for the games that have been played here in Vancouver, you know, when before the game, even if it's not a game Canada is playing in, because Canada only played one game here, you get a big fan march from the different teams, and they organize sort of over by Science World, and then they walk over to the stadium in a giant. So it's been kind of cool to see, like, as you say, like, different nationalities and the local communities coming out to support their team, and quite a lot of people. You know, you'll get 2,000-3,000 people all bunched into this parade, fan parade, all in their fan jerseys and stuff like that.
I don't know if it's doing worth their chant.
Like, Turkey had a big one, and Egypt had a big one, and it was very, it was
and
pretty
Rick
fun.
And Rick had a big bill for the whole thing.
That's true.
One thing I like to do a bit of a backtrack here. I have somebody who's staying at St. Paul's, and I see him, more than twice a week or so. And I don't know, like, I'm kind of, I think we couldn't get water or something. We got it from someone else, but it was because they make a big thing. We can't get the water ourselves or something. So I don't know. I mean, they have a reason for striking or whatever it is, but it does cause inconvenience. And there's a kind of an argument to say they shouldn't be allowed to do it, I guess, really. But I don't know. Like,
yeah. I mean, they do have, you know, essential services provisions in place. So, you know, it's not like everybody goes out. When someone like nurses or firefighters or other people in those kinds of occupations go on strike. So, in terms of results, Canada got knocked out on Saturday afternoon against Morocco in a pretty exciting game. Paraguay also got knocked out by France. Yesterday afternoon, Brazil, one of the favorites for the tournament, got knocked out the first time since 1990, I think, or maybe it was 86, a long time, by Norway. That was a very exciting game. I was cheering for Norway because my family background is from Norway.
And so you went there a little while ago, didn't you?
Yes, I went last year to visit family and stuff.
Are you 100% Norwegian or just a...
Yes, I'm 100%. Both my parents.
I'm half Danish, I'm half French. That's my ancestry.
Yeah, my parents married in Norway and then moved to Canada.
Okay.
And then had us kids here.
You're not a half-breed.
So, you know, by genetics, I'm 100% Norwegian, but I was actually born here in Canada.
But isn't that sort of like saying, you were born in the state of Georgia or New York as being as ethnicity in a way? Because it's like, it's sort of one gene pool all of Europe in a way.
Kind of. You know,
I guess the Italians are darker or... And then they have the... I don't know. I'm just saying that it's interesting we kind of have this... idea. It's almost like it's genetic when it kind of really isn't. In
a way. So Brazil got knocked out in a very exciting game. Mexico also got knocked out, which is a bit by England, which is a bit sad because the Mexicans have been very, Mexican fans here in Vancouver have been very visible supporting their team in the fan zone area and downtown on Granville Island after their victories so far. So that'll be missed, I guess, along with the Canadian stuff, too.
Oh, one thing I'd like to bring up is that, like, this was about 20 years ago I found out about this, was we kind of go with, like, a three-racial theory in our heads. But actually, it's about 20 races. There's about 20 races. So it's more than just the... But we see it as Oriental, Caucasian, and Black. It's actually even more. There's about 20 altogether.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, when it comes to, I don't want to, you know, race is a very difficult topic, but I will say that, you know, in many ways, you know, we develop the ideas around race around what are, for the most part, fundamentally superficial characteristics. Well, I mean, they're visually important, but they're not actually... significant it's much actually, beyond that.
It's actually skin. It's actually sometimes it's rather superficial. It's the skin formation.
Yeah.
Even though in some cases, I think an episode of MASH brought this up, about Klinger couldn't take some type of medication because of his racial, whatever it is. It was something about that. Sometimes it is a bit something like that. But usually it's pretty superficial.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, you're also talking about, it's a funny topic to get into off the cuff, but you're also talking about, you know, populations that are working together, and not working together, but, you know, in some degrees isolated, you know, people from Africa, people from Europe, people from East Asia, you know, up until pretty recent times, there was not a lot of intermixing there because traveling between those places was very difficult and very rare. So, of course... You know, beyond the superficial qualities we can easily see when we look at different people, you know, they do also create, you know, there are various sort of medical things that some people are more susceptible to this and some people are more susceptible to that. And, you know, but that seems, you know, that less about race perhaps than it is just about how these populations sort of developed over a fairly extended period of time in relative isolation from each other. So, anyway,
yes, because that is one good thing about the, what is it, FIFA?
The World Cup.
Yeah,
and it does really bring, you know, it's funny, there is a lot of nationalism around it, and all these tournaments build on nationalism to some degree, but it feels like a little less nationalistic than, say, the Olympics, in the sense that people are pretty willing to, they support a number of different teams, not just their own team. And, you know, as their own team gets knocked out, because that's what the tournament's about, you know, people do sort of shift their allegiance and continue to support other teams. And it's nice for that. And I guess it was last week or maybe 2 weeks ago, was when Canada won their game, wasn't the home game, and Mexico won their game on the same day. And I was downtown with a friend later that evening, and all the Canada-Mexico fans were all celebrating together because both squads had won their game, and they were all dancing and cheering and letting off their smoke things and, you know, arm in arm with each other. And it was good to see, you know?
Okay.
So the little controversy, too, in the World Cup this week, too, because I don't know if you heard about this one, Peter, but there's an American striker, one of the forwards, who got a red card in the last game for what was an illegal tackle or illegal, you know, stepping on another guy's foot. And he got a red card. And there's been discussion all ever since then about whether that was legitimate and appropriate. And now, of course, things have flipped the other way because FIFA has canceled the red card. Because one of the consequences is that he would have missed the next game, which is their round of 16 game today, I think. But now he's perhaps going to play, and now the opposing team there is upset, and there's apparently Trump's involved in some way.
Everybody but me knows what a red card is. What is this?
Well, one of the penalties in soccer is you can get a free kick or you can get a penalty kick, depending where it happens, which those happen on the field. For certain kinds of fouls, you get a yellow card. And if you get two yellow cards, you get ejected from the game. If you get a red card, you get ejected from the game immediately. And you're also sitting out the next game. So that's what happened there. So the guy got one of their best players, best American players, got this red card. People were very upset about it. Americans thought it wasn't. A lot of debate online about it. And now apparently it's been reversed and somehow Trump's involved. At least he says so. We don't know whether that's just, you know.
Well, one thing I'm wondering is soccer like Canadian American football, where you have not all the players of the team on the field? Or is it like hockey where it's like, they're basically on, unless they get the penalty box and they're off. So how does soccer work?
Soccer's really different from a lot of other sports like that, because you have your starting lineup, and then over the course of the game, you have a limited number of substitutions. So you can swap out a limited number of players. I'm not actually sure what the number is. It's not very many, though. There's like, you know, 11 players on the field, and you can maybe swap out four or five.
Oh, so you got
over the course
bench.
Of the entire game. Like, you can't, it's not like hockey where you can have shifts and people are on for 2 minutes and off. Right? Very, you know. I saw one, you know, there's a, they listed a quick stat at the end of the Norway game yesterday afternoon where one of the chief Norwegian players, and I guess they can track this with, you know, modern computer tracking and stuff like that in the videos, but they said that he played the entire game, about 95 minutes, and he ran 12.7 kilometers over the course of the game, which is quite a lot, you know, in that period of time. You know, so you got to imagine what the conditioning is for these players needs to be able to keep up that pace throughout the game. But it's also why those limited, you know, substitutions are important too, because you're bringing on fresh players while other players have been, you know, already run 10 kilometers for the day.
Well, this soccer doesn't sound that complicated, but do you know the actual rules of Canadian and American football, Magnus? Because I don't. You know, they got people that got season's tickets to the BC Lions. I met them on the SkyTrain because, you know, they're all plugged up with these people. But they will confess to me, but they don't even know the rules to football.
I know a lot of rules, but that's a whole for the games. And I don't, but I'm not I'm by no means an expert on the finer details. But that's a discussion for another day. All right, we're going to go. We have Sean Orr's a Vancouver city councillor, and he's been pushing for a low-income transit pass for the Vancouver region, and Danny Nesvedarani had a chat with him about it.
Reporting from Vancouver, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. During a June 3rd Vancouver City Council meeting, City Councilor Sean Orr put forward a motion to create a low-income transit pass for Vancouver residents earning less than $40,000 yearly. The original motion called on city staff to work with the Lower Mainland's transit authority, TransLink, to develop a $25 per month transit pass. The motion was unanimously approved, although with a few amendments. The amended motion now directs city staff to advocate to TransLink and the provincial government to fund and implement the low-income transit pass, rather than Vancouver City Council and city staff. To find out more about this low-income transit pass motion, CJSF reached out to its author, City Councilor Sean Orr. During our conversation, Orr explained what originally spurred him to pursue this motion for a low-income transit pass in Vancouver.
Well, it's sort of been a long time coming in terms of, you know, COPE and my party has long advocated for affordable transit. My predecessor, Gene Swanson, as a part of a campaign called All On Board, was able to get free transit for kids under 12. Of course, you know, there's an opportunity to increase that to teens as well, up to under 18, and that's something that I've been looking at. Really, it was this group called Movement, Metro Vancouver Transit Riders, and they've just been doing a lot of advocacy around the low-income transit pass. I met with them, you know, I think last fall, and they had a number of sort of like asks for transit, and I was heading to UBCM. And I said I'd try and raise it with the minister, and I did. But you have, like, at UBCM, you have like 5 minutes in a room with all the counselors and one MLA, and it's really difficult to get anything in there. So I decided to move a motion on it, and I did a bit of research and looked at all the other cities that are doing it, and Vancouver's one of the only cities in Canada that isn't doing it. And I thought, you know, we should be leaders in this and not sort of playing catch up. I think, you know, this is especially one of the most expensive cities on the planet, let alone in Canada. So it's just it just seemed like a no brainer. And I'd been sitting on it for a while, actually. You know, the way that council moves, you're trying to plan like your weeks. And I knew there was only a few coming up because, you know, FIFA's here, and so there isn't a lot of meetings during this time. The next one is actually July 15th. And in July, I think 28th or 29th is the last meeting before the election, the last chance. So I was just trying to strategize when to fit it in, and I did so the other day. And it passed, but it passed with some amendments, of course.
As we mentioned earlier, the motion did pass unanimously, although it did receive some amendments from other city councilors, specifically from other councilors who believed that it was not in the city's jurisdiction to fund the project and that they should advocate for the provincial government to support the low-income transit pass.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of a larger trend that the majority does. There's actually an article about it in the Georgia Strait about how if they don't want to look bad voting no on something, they'll just amend it to sort of be meaningless or just water it down. I mean, there was, I think the biggest one and the one that spurred the article was a motion by Councillor Fry, actually, to amend asking for a sex worker planning position. And that really sort of initiated the article. But I mean, this is a practice that has been going on for months. They just, you know, really weaken a motion, and they'll change anything if it has anything monetary to do with the city. They'll be like, no, they'll cut that out. And so in this case, you know, we were looking at, you know, grants. We were looking at, staff time and things like that. So they switched it to just purely an advocacy motion, and I'm fine with that. It didn't really gut the motion like some of the other times when they do it.
Lastly, it can be difficult to know where a motion like this ends up once it's been taken to the provincial government. So we asked Sean Orr what he thinks the next steps may be in advocating for a low-income transit pass in Vancouver.
That's a really good question, because like I've had a few motions, and oftentimes when it leaves council chambers, it's just kind of like into the ether a little bit, and it's like kind of out of my hands in a sense. You know, when I pass a motion, they don't go, okay, great, here, you know, like, we'll expect to hear from us in 6 months. Like, it just kind of goes into that kind of bureaucratic machine, and it comes back at some point. Maybe we'll get a report or something, maybe in the next year. Or, you know, I passed a motion recently on really bright LED headlights. And again, road safety and public safety. And, you know, I was asked the same question. I'm like, I don't know, actually, you know, but it turns out Transport Canada actually did a survey where they released it across the country. A Bloc Québécois MP actually brought a parliamentary petition to ban these LED headlights. And then, of course, it went to the Federation of Canadian Municipalities, which just happened last week in Edmonton, where delegates from across Canada overwhelmingly voted to support changing the regulations on these bright LED headlights. So that's one thing where, like, I didn't know at first, but that there is this, it does happen. There is this sort of kind of slow churning thing that happens. And so, but even then, like, now after FCM is going to advocate now to Transport Canada to change the regulations. So it is kind of now out of my hands, but a lot of that's a kind of a big feeling when you pass a motion in council. It's like, I don't know, now what? Like, what happens next? You know, and I am so new, right? So it's like, oftentimes it's like, okay, I guess now on to the next thing. And that's just it. Like, everything moves so fast.
So while city council has put forward this motion, and it is now up to city staff to advocate to the provincial government and TransLink for this low-income transit pass, the results of the motion are yet to be seen. As things progress, CJSF will make sure to reach out to Vancouver City Council, TransLink, and the provincial government to learn more about how this motion is progressing. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks to Danny for that report. Next up is Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. Author Christian Cooper is never not birding, even at the movies. Like when he was watching the 2006 film Apocalypto, an action thriller set in what is now Mexico during the Mayan Empire.
And so they show a river, and they show a cattle egret at the river. And I'm like, nope, no good. And a lot of people would say, no, there are cattle egrets in Mesoamerica. And that's correct. There are cattle egrets in Mesoamerica now.
Western cattle egrets are common birds on several continents today, but they're originally from Africa. The birds weren't found in the Americas until the late 1800s, possibly because they were blown off course during migration.
For me, that's a perfect metaphor of the African diaspora experience, that we people of African descent, you know, got dragged across the ocean by no fault of our own, and yet here we are, and we found a way to thrive and live here and make our way here, just like the cattle egret. So to me, the cattle egret is the spirit of Black lives set loose into the air. So I just love the cattle egret.
Hear more stories about birds on screen in Season 8 of Bring Birds Back. Available in your favorite podcast app and on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Jonice Franklin.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. This is Speak Up. Speak Up comes to you every weekday, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, and a special edition Intravenous on Wednesdays at 10 a.m. And next up, we have Gardening with Embark. But before we get to that, I want to remind you that if you have anything you want to let us, if you have any thing you want to say about or let us know about things we're talking about on the radio, or songs you've heard or music we've played or anything like that.